Hello, listeners.
Welcome back to Neurodivergent Moments.
I'm so excited about today's episode. We've wanted to get her on for so long.
Yeah, it's taken a bit of back and forth, but we finally did it, guys, ladies and gentlemen, and people. We have Jess Tom as our guest.
Her book is amazing. Her whole like worldview is so brilliant, and like every time I hear her speak or have an interview of her, she's got like some new like idea or way of looking at the world that like changes my way of thinking.
Yeah, I took a lot away from it. I don't want to give too much of the conversation away because you'll hear it in the interview, but especially when she was talking about relaxed spaces and the conversations that you have in building a more accessible world. I just found really enlightening and really heartening, and it made me think a lot about the performance spaces which I use and how we can make them better and more accessible for people.
Yeah, definitely. No, I found it so helpful. And I think, like, we talked about this after the interview, a lot of my hesitancy around stuff is I'm scared of getting in trouble. That's my whole life is just scared of getting in trouble. And I think that sometimes makes me not do enough in terms of accessibility, because I'm scared of getting it wrong, and then you get nothing. And I think that's not the way to do it. I have to be brave about getting in trouble.
Yeah, and also like take like criticisms about accessibility as just that, like pieces of information you can have to make things better, you know. So for those of you who don't know Jess, she has a mix of neurodivergencies, one being Tourette's, and she is also a wheelchair user. So for instance, one of the things we came across in trying to find a space where we could record was finding something that was wheelchair accessible. And there's a couple of places that said they were wheelchair accessible, but they were like, no, we have a ramp, but we don't have a bathroom.
It was an insight into how inaccessible particularly London, but also the world is.
Yeah, and in that, like, not that I didn't talk specifically to that venue after the fact, but after talking to Jess, on their website, they said they were wheelchair accessible.
Yeah.
The way I would suggest they amend it is say, we have ramp access, elevator access, we do not have accessible toilets. Like the venue we wound up using to record in not only said they were wheelchair accessible, but listed how they were wheelchair accessible.
Yeah.
And then that takes a lot of back and forth out of the conversation. Because also with dealing with Jess' team and them asking about accessibility, we were booked for a place because we were like, they say they're wheelchair accessible. And her team came back with, are you sure? And it just goes to show you how much double checking you actually have to do
for these things,
you know? And they're used to it at this point, whereas I was like, no, it says on the website, so why wouldn't it be? And it's like,
We made the mistake of going, why would something on the internet lie?
Yeah.
We believed everything on the internet.
Yeah. Abraham Lincoln famously said, everything on the internet is true.
Yes. speaking of things, we do need to make a correction before this interview, because early on, Jess ticks about Gloria Hunniford. And then we talk briefly about Gloria Hunniford, and she says, I don't know much about her. I know that she's not alive anymore. Gloria Hunniford is alive, just to reassure if there's any friends or family of Gloria Hunniford, she is still alive. She's doing well. She's 84 years old. She was on The Masked Singer a couple of years ago, and she's thriving as far as I'm aware.
Oh, wow. Beautiful. 84 years young.
Yes.
Wonderful. Good for her. It's a great interview. Let's play it. Let's let it rip.
Thanks.
Thank you. Back here.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gloria Hunniford's box. Why am I talking about her so much today?
I don't know who Gloria Hunniford is.
I mean, I don't think I know who Gloria Hunniford is. I sort of know who she is. I know which. I know that she's not alive anymore, and that she maybe was an agony aunt. But that's the thing about my tics. Often, I have to look them up.
Really?
I had no idea who Alan Hansen was, but I talk about him so often.
So how do the names get in your brain? But you just hear them.
Anything I've heard, anything I've ever known, experienced, heard can become a tic. But why is a mystery, and anything can come up at any point. Biscuit. I once ticked that Keith Duffy was allergic to peanuts. Keith Duffy being a member of Boyzone. I assumed that was just a tick and that wasn't true. And at some point, I looked it up. And he is allergic to peanuts.
He is allergic to peanuts.
So either...
you made him allergic to peanuts.
I'm a poor voyant. Tourette's gives me some sort of psychic ability. Or I must have come across that at some point and not remembered it. But I'm not a massive Boyzone fan. I have no... conscious memory or knowledge of ever having been exposed to that fact, but it's often a surprise what things I say as tics, but also that my tics often collide biscuit ideas together to create like new concepts and put things next to each other that would never normally sit next to each other. Peter Andre and Biscuit and a doll called Sarah. I mean.
Yeah.
For example.
Yeah.
Because you're...
Donkey Kong and a rhino.
On your website, and there is like a poetry to your text.
Biscuit.
But I don't think I could come up with... I'd have to spend a good day to come up with one.
Hedgehog.
That sort of had that poetry. Fuck. It's not
Hedgehog.
Just random words. There's a sort of...
Biscuit.
Yeah.
That's one of the really confusing things about Tourette's, is that it's involuntary, it's totally automatic, it's not my thoughts, or like, you know, I don't think about biscuits nearly as much as I talk about them. Certainly don't think about Alan Hansen as much as I talk about him. Fuck it. I love you, Alan. But it's also not nonsense. Biscuit, they have they're very much of me. They're like, there is, my tics have the imprint of like where I grew up, when I grew up, like the things I've experienced, the spaces I've been in. Biscuit, long live Palestine, long live Gaza. Biscuit, that became a regular tick. That's been a regular tick for the last few months. And it's like, so there are the sort of the print of the spaces and people and things that are important to me or that I've spent time in are like present within my tics. But how they get mixed up with other stuff is... really interesting. I think there's quite a lot about how Tourette's works, or what Tourette's, the reality of living with Tourette's, which is incredibly complicated and way more complicated than I think lots of the sort of presentations of it or that most people would sort of commonly think. Like, there are lots of aspects to it that I think people don't know about. But I think it has a lot to tell us about how all of our brains work, because it constantly surprises me. One of the joys, I think, about having Tourette's, Biscuit, is that it draws attention to details in the world, Biscuit, that I wouldn't otherwise notice. So I had this very strange and ongoing, Biscuit relationship with the lamppost that I can see from my bedroom window, where every night I will, put on my pyjamas, brush my teeth, get into bed, and then... abuse the lamppost till I fall asleep. Biscuit. But
that sounds sexual.
But lampposts live off the state. Lamppost, Biscuit, they're jealous of the moon. Lamppost, I love you. So it's over time, there's this like a really interesting like relationship develops with space and surroundings. Biscuit, and things that I just wouldn't have a connection to or pay attention to if it wasn't for my unusual neurology, plugging into them in a way. But like, why? And I don't care why. Those things aren't things that are important to me. What has become important to me is valuing that perspective and valuing the tics and the spontaneous creativity that they give me access to.
That was a big takeaway from your book for me, was like, it almost felt like, obviously it's about you, but also a portrait of like the British public a lot. There are lots of interactions with people in the public, and it felt like it felt very British to me, the sort of interactions that you had.
Petra.
And there was it felt like those aspects were quite like, there's part of me sort of quite jealous of sort of going, well, you get to have all these sort of spontaneous interactions with people and sort of find out, have those interactions.
100%. And I think there are opportunities and challenges of that. Biscuit, I think, you know, Tourette's is a condition that changes and fluctuates and surprises me all the time. Biscuit and Biscuit people will be able to hear Biscuit. My vocal tics, the regular vocal tics include saying Biscuit and Hedgehog and Cats. Fuck, Biscuit. And you'll also probably be able to hear a regular motor tic, which is banging my chest. I bang my chest hundreds of times a day. So, like, the physical and sort of aspects of having Tourette's is one thing, and that's sort of the facts about how my body and brain work. That's unpredictable, and that changes each day, and tics change. Fuck. But the other thing that's really unpredictable is how people respond. And when I first started writing for the Tourette's Era blog, which was like I was writing every day, Biscuit, before that, I think I would have always been able to, if someone asked me about public responses, I would go to the difficult times, the times people had said something upsetting or that I'd felt frightened or had been discriminated against or had been scared. Those took up a lot of space in my mind and in my heart. I was very aware of negative responses to me. One of the things about giving space and writing every day, one of the things that really helped me appreciate was actually how much spontaneous support, interesting conversations and like funny shared laughter was also a big part of my experience. And it wasn't until I was allowing space to think about Tourette's and allowing space to write about it, and that really helped me hold on to those glorious moments of shared connection and joy. And I think that's totally natural, but I felt really lucky to have had that opportunity to spot that and appreciate that and recognize that, and conversations and those connections, and like I get to talk to people who I would never get to talk to if it wasn't for my tics. They often start the conversation. That isn't always a choice, and that can feel a lot, and I don't have anonymity in public space. Fuck. And, you know, there's some days where you don't want to have to explain or educate. Like, talking to other people about Tourette's doesn't always feel like a choice to me. It feels like an essential tool for navigating the world. But disabled people should have more agency over Biscuit, what they disclose and when. But I also recognise the power of that openness and how surprising those fuck conversations can be. I work with children and young people, and Biscuit, I've had some of the most incredible conversations with children about bodies and brains and the different ways that they work. And fuck, I feel like as much as my tics surprise me, the variety and nuance of people's responses and perspectives, fuck, also like continues to surprise me and be really interesting. Fuck.
Can you give us like a story or an example of a time you were out in public and you had that like shared awesome experience?
Hedgehog, Biscuit, Cats. I mean, there's so, like, I think there's just so many of moments of sort of shared connection. I think some of my favourites are with toddlers. As a wheelchair user who, you know, on a bus in London, there's like only one space that I can sit, but it's often where the kids in buggies sit too. And I've had in that space, sharing that space with toddlers in particular, who I think that certainly to start with often behave like my tics are like, they just have such joy in them and will often copy them. And adults will be really nervous and ignore that, but children are curious and will ask the interesting and curious questions. But importantly, will also listen to the answers. I had an interaction with someone on a bus once where he started off saying to me, oh, do you mind if I ask you a question? And I was like, oh, here we go. And I was like, I was expecting
that's never
it.
A good start to anything.
Yeah, I was expecting it to be like a sort of, invasive impairment related question. But he actually wanted to talk to me about the fact that he'd seen a wheelchair user who could do a backflip. And I was like, and it's so like, it's so, it was a really important reminder to me that Biscuit actually, then people aren't always like that, people will have like really varied responses and to like go with that and enjoy that. I think another moment was the first Fat Biscuit, the first time we did anything really creative with my tics, at the very start of starting Tourette's Hero. Like fundamentally,
wait a minute, we gotta back up, because
fuck,
I didn't get the answer he asked. Can you do a backflip?
Yeah,
I can't do a backflip. But we, some wheelchair users can. And we had this long, detailed conversation about WCMX, which is wheelchair skateboarding and wheelchair, doing tricks. I can't do that.
Okay.
But I love watching it. And I do love wheelchairs. I love thinking about, talking about. I'm a total wheelchair geek. This, we could very easily go off on that.
Yeah.
Is that like a subculture, like the way people are about sneakers or whatever? Is that
100%.
Right.
100%. And I think the thing that's interesting about wheelchairs is that for many non-disabled people, particularly for many non-wheelchair users, firstly, people often think that all wheelchairs are the same, and they're not, just like all sneakers aren't the same. They're also tools for living, so people use them in different ways. And I think there's often like really binary ideas about wheelchair use that puts people off using them, or this perception that that's like the worst case scenario, and that somehow wheelchairs are often used in the general public as a sort of description of like limits or things being really bad, or like definitely like the worst case scenario. Biscuit, as a wheelchair user, and pretty much like lots of wheelchair users I meet, will talk about their chairs as liberators, the freedom. For me, it means that I can go places and do things that I would not be able to do without my chair. It means I get a lot less head injuries. And I think why it matters how we talk about mobility aid tools is because people put off using things that would radically transform their lives in positive and joyful ways. Mm-hmm. But because of how perceptions about it, I put off using a wheelchair for ages. And when I go back and think about why that was, Biscuit, none of that was about what I needed or what would work for me. And so much of that was about my fear of how other people would respond, what people's perceptions, or this idea that somehow that would be seen as things getting worse, rather than me accessing a tool that allowed me to keep living and doing the things that I wanted with the most autonomy and safety. Fuck, hedgehog, cats.
Because you're someone who, for me, like, I talk about Biscuit. The social model, but it feels like you're like,
fuck.
Like, if the social model was like a political thing, I'd be like the Labour Party and you'd be some sort of like extreme left party of the social model. That's a bad analogy, but do you know what I mean?
Like, I totally know
what really
you mean.
You really take the social model to the...
Well, I think that the social model isn't perfect, and it's had its faults, and it doesn't work for everybody or for all experiences. Why I think it's useful, and what it did for me. So the social model of disability is the idea that it's normal for bodies and minds, Biscuit, to work in different ways, and some people to have specific conditions or impairments, and others not. What is disabling is a failure to consider a diversity of bodies in the way that we set up and structure society. So it's not my tics and Tourette's that make me a disabled person. They're my impairment, they're facts about my body, that's how it is. But the lived experience of barriers because of non-accessible environments, systems, mm-hmm. and attitudes, that lived experience of disabling barriers is the thing that makes me a disabled person in sort of my understanding of it. And why that's powerful is that the like medical models and charity models and lots of the models that have gone before in terms of how we think about disability all focused on individuals, and on they were individual models that saw the only way to address disabling barriers or disability was to change the person through treatment, through the benevolence of non-disabled people, through pity. The thing that I like about the social model is that it takes a collective approach. It's not about changing individuals, but it's about changing environments, changing systems, mm-hmm. changing attitudes, changing structures. Often when people explain the social model, Biscuit, they only use environmental examples, because it's really easy to say, if I can't get into a building as a wheelchair user, Biscuit, because it's surrounded by steps, the medical and charity models would see my wobbly legs as the problem and the barrier, and therefore would focus on trying to fix me, whereas the social model would identify the steps as the disabling barrier. Biscuit, and there are solutions for that, ramps and lifts. And that's totally accurate. Like, describing those physical and environmental barriers is totally true. But it means that people often miss all of the other ways, types of barrier. So, for example, as someone who experiences chronic pain and has energy-related barriers, the assumption that everyone has the same amount of energy and that scheduling always works in the same way, that is a social model issue and is a disabling barrier. Access to pain relief, that is, approaches to pain and understanding that some people live their life with pain, that is a barrier and a social model issue, in my view. So I probably am a bit of a, like, it did something really powerful for me, learning about, and not just learning about, but at the moment that I really connected with that way of thinking was suddenly radical for me, because it's like, I'm not the problem. I don't have to change myself, but I can be part of the solution. I can be part of changing the world to make less disabling spaces, systems and attitudes. Mm-hmm. Biscuit, and that, rather than feeling like passive, that gave me power. And, you know, Tourette's hero, it's very like Tourette's hero for me. And like, we use a sort of superhero identity, which is a bit like, which is really problematic history in relation to disability. But for me, part of the thing about Tourette's hero is, you know, we wanted a character that appealed to children and adults and that was playful. But also, it's a, for me, that is about, not about saying that Tourette's gives me any special skills or superpowers. It's about saying that we all have power, but that might look or feel really different, and we need to find the things that make us feel powerful and give us agency for an autonomy in our lives. And often, as disabled and neurodivergent people, we are expected to change ourselves to fit in to normative ways of doing things. Biscuit, and I often like this idea of the fact that we live in a normative supremacy, where like normative bodies and minds are often the only ones that are thought about and have total dominance. And as soon as you need to do something in a different way, whether that's communicating in a different way, whether that's managing sensory sensitivities, whether that's using a wheelchair, those things are automatically seen as less. The correct way of doing things is the normative way of doing things. But the thing is, no one has a body or mind that works in a totally predictable way. But often we shape the world for this imaginary normative body and mind that doesn't really exist. And loads of people will experience barriers because of that. But the medical and charity models have conditioned us to think that that is a individual and personal problem and our own bad luck, and that all of the solutions are just about us being good, quiet, compliant, disabled people. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think the social model redirects us in terms of where we place the emphasis, and allows us to think about collective solutions and collective responsibilities, shared responsibilities for creating a more accessible world. And that's why I think it's powerful.
It makes me think, my partner is
Hedgehog.
Autistic, and he just did a panel talking about accessibility, I think, within film and television. I didn't go to the panel. I wasn't paying attention.
Hedgehog.
But I heard it.
Sausage.
On a Zoom meeting with the people beforehand.
Biscuit.
And they were talking about how sometimes before recordings, they'll ask certain people for their accessibility needs.
Yeah.
And I thought it was interesting, because at first I didn't quite understand what they were talking about. But then I was like, actually, that's kind of cool. Like, so Tom, as an autistic person and fairly newly diagnosed, doesn't always know what to ask for and doesn't necessarily know what he needs, and also feels a little bit pointed to when it's like, what do you need?
Yeah.
And they were talking and one of the other people was like, I'm not neurodivergent.
Hedgehog.
But one thing I would like people to know going into a shoot is just that I'm a very blunt person. But like, if everyone had like, what do you call them? Accessibility lists.
Like accessibility rider.
Accessibility rider. Yeah. If everyone was given one, then it would be like a normal, no one would feel targeted. And then the person who's like, I just want you to know that I'm really blunt, would be able to tell people that. And then the other person who's like, I need to take a break. break every half hour feels comfortable saying that, as opposed to like one per, okay, we have to rebuild this whole structure around this one person.
Yeah.
And at first I was a bit like, well, that's not what an accessibility writer should be. And then I thought about it, and I was like, I actually kind of like that idea.
Of course.
Of just 100%. Everyone going, this is what I need. And then everyone going, okay, we can do that.
But we, and that's part, like, we're, like, that idea about being open and talking about what works for you and allowing space for that negotiation, because there is sometimes access friction, what someone might need might rub up against something else. But if you have those conversations openly and create flexible environments that can respond and sort of normalize that, it's really powerful. And I think one of the things that I often say is that there's often this assumption that disabled people automatically know what their access requirements are, that we're somehow given some sort of list and it's like, these are the things that you should ask for. It doesn't work that like that. Biscuit, generally, you people work out what they require through a painful mix of getting it really right, getting it really wrong, and learning from other disabled and neurodivergent people. And one of the things I would really like to see more is more space for experimenting with access. And that's like allowing people to test out tools or provisions. So we often at Tourette Zero talk about an access without judgment approach, where we will include access provisions within our artwork, within our programs. We will factually describe what is available, but not make assumptions about exactly who that's for or how that will be used. It's really important to make sure specific access requirements and provisions work for the communities who rely on them. Biscuit. But it's also really important to allow space for experimentation and learning and building knowledge of yourself and what works. For example, I was in Biscuit. I was at an event in Canada, and I was in a lot of pain. And then we were in this performance, and it was an amazing performance, and I was really enjoying it. But I was in agony and really needed to get out of my wheelchair and lie flat on the ground. Biscuit, in lots of spaces, I would then have to make the choice between leaving the space and being comfortable and not in pain or in less pain, or staying in the space and being uncomfortable but enjoying and participating in the performance. Biscuit, because it was a disability arts event and because they had this sort of an access without judgment type approach, I knew that there was audio description, live audio description. They'd made it clear that anyone could use it. So I was able to get out of my chair, lie on the floor, and use the audio description that would have been originally been, you know, was intended or designed for blind and partially sighted people to be able to access performance. But I was able to use it as someone who experienced pain, be able to be comfortable and still participate and stay in the space. Mm. Biscuit, I don't think I'd have felt comfortable to do that in some environments where those provisions might have still existed, but there would have been much more gatekeeping about who had access to them. And I think, you know, that is a balance, and that's often that's about like resources feeling in short supply. And but I'm really up for sort of a really generous and open approach to access where people are encouraged to test out, play around, like work, like try things out, Biscuit, because that's how you build knowledge of yourself, and that's also how we learn and continually make access better. I think often there's this idea, Biscuit, that, you know, you make something accessible and then that's achieved. That's not the reality. I'm more or less disabled in different spaces depending on how thoughtfully they've been set up. And access is the process of constantly identifying disabling barriers and working to remove them. Biscuit, as soon as you stop that process and think it's something that you've done, those barriers have a nasty habit of reappearing either in the same place or in different places, just like with other forms of systemic oppression. And that knowledge sharing and openness and getting like normalizing, talking about what we need as human beings, I think is really, really essential, because that's how we'll make spaces that work better for all of us.
Mm-hmm.
Fuck, sausage, goat sex pajamas. I mean, goat sex pajamas may or may not be relevant to that, but who knows? Hedgehog.
Before we started recording, you had a tick about Richard Hammond and someone else in a bath, and I had to turn to you and be like, I don't know if that's a tick or if you're Hedgehog. Telling me a great story.
Sausage.
Talking about, like, accessing creativity, like, do your ticks ever lead you to, like, an amazing short story or
for
like
biscuit,
a bit
hedgehog.
Of a bit of writing or a comedy piece, because
yeah,
some of the things
fuck you, sausage
like Joe said, it's hedgehog. Like they're poetic
biscuit, yeah. And I think one of the, you know, my friends will often say to me that like I'm funny as Jess about like once every 6 months, but fortunately my tics have a much higher hit rate, and I think that was like at the heart of like starting Tourette's Zero. I've had tics since I was a child, since I was about 6. They began to intensify and have a much bigger impact on my life in my sort of early 20s. And as they intensified, I found that transition really difficult, and increasingly I like restricted my life in response and tried to like hide and ignore what was happening. Biscuit. I was working in sort of inclusive adventure play, so in adventure playgrounds for disabled and non-disabled children, with my friend and colleague Matthew, and he was really supportive during that transition, and we had lots of conversations about Tourette's and my tics, often which ended in tears. And then we had this conversation that just transformed everything for me, and in it he describes Tourette's as a language generating machine, biscuit, and told me that not doing something creative with it would be wasteful. And I was able to hear that sentence in a totally different way, biscuit, than I'd heard anything else before. It really got into my brain and took root, and was the start of Tourette's Zero. And the very first creative thing really that we did in the sort of spirit of that was this thing called Live Talk, where I had a conversation with Alex Newman, who was a friend of mine, who he did lots of like audio description for films and had a really amazing like voice, sounding like smooth voice. And so we did this sort of fake radio show and called Live Talk, where instead of ignoring my tics, biscuit, we would follow them and we would let them tell stories and see where that would take us. And it was the most incredibly, biscuit, liberating, freeing, exciting thing, because rather than having a conversation like we are now, biscuit, where my tics are sort of an interruption or a fact, they're just a sort of part of the sort of soundscape of the space. Instead of just, you know, doing that, we really followed them and let them take us, let them lead us to some really strange places. And it did get really weird, but it also was really freeing and felt really exciting. And I think that was the sort of start of this my sort of practice as an artist. I will often talk about Tourette's as a collaborator, one of the collaborators in the room, biscuit, and that I really like mixing ticked language and involuntary language with sort of chosen ideas and thoughts, and not necessarily like mixing them together and not necessarily saying which is which often people are really keen to try and like unpick what's like voluntary and involuntary. I just don't know, I find it really exciting to blur the boundaries of that and allow, and I think some of that is also accepting fuck tics and Tourette's as part of me. And I do have this weird relationship sometimes with them, when somebody's like, oh, that's a really funny or poetic tic, I feel like I can't like have a strange response to that, and I don't feel like I can claim responsibility for that, like that's
right,
because it's not something I've chosen to do or put any energy in to doing. So but there was this moment when I started writing that for Tourette's Zero where I made the conscious choice to start saying my tics and my Tourette's, whereas previously I'd always sort of said the tics and the Tourette's and had this like slight barrier, and like accepting that while they're involuntary, while they're not things I'm choosing, they are of me and they are the product of my brain. And I can, like, there was this, that moment of like accepting them within my life. Fuck was a real transformation for me, because I meant I could be proud of the fullness of myself, rather than feeling like they were like, and that they had value and that they were interesting and that they were worth like paying attention to sometimes. I obviously can't pay attention to them all the time because I wouldn't get anything done, biscuit. But yeah, I feel like recognizing and valuing that the spontaneous creativity that the way my brain works gives me access to.
Because now you have a great relationship with your lamp.
Now I've got a great relationship with my lamppost, hedgehog, biscuit, and with Alan Hansen.
Yeah.
Fuck it.
You're someone who...
Peter Andre,
I know, I think, sort of thinks about
cow?
The language around.
Wait, what did he do?
I mean, I said he spunked up a cow.
I am. Keep going. Let's do the game now.
a cow in a tutu with Peter Andre's foreskin draped over its nose. I mean, that's a pretty extreme piece of imagery. Fuck. Sausage.
Sorry, I interrupted you. I was like, let's keep going. I mean, we're all going to get to a very serious point
about the social model. And,
and I'm cows!
Like, let's talk about the cows, Spunk.
Spunky.
Because your live shows, you do them as relaxed performances.
Fact. Yeah.
I've sort, with my tour, I've Hedgehog. Been sort of dipping my toe in it a bit. I think my worry is, and I'd be interested to know your thoughts
Hedgehog
on this,
biscuit.
Is I don't want to overpromise with like a relaxed performance. And I worry, I don't build them as relaxed performances because I don't want to...
Fuck.
You're promising something that's not there.
But if you don't say that they're relaxed performances, people won't know they're relaxed performances.
Yeah.
And that they're welcome. And that they're like, and they won't know what a relaxed performance is. So they won't know. It'd be like, oh, my sister could have come to this. My mum could have come to this.
Right.
And I understand the instinct around access. There's often a load of anxiety about getting it wrong. And this is part of that same thing about experimentation. Not only are disabled people and neurodivergent people not encouraged to experiment with access, people providing access so obvious, often feel like they have to get it right first time, straight away, 100%, rather than understanding that as a process. And learning is about trying stuff out and working out what does and doesn't work. The thing is, if you try, I'm so used as a disabled person, as a wheelchair user, as someone who experiences pain, as someone who has energy related barriers, I'm so used to not being thought about within spaces. That's the normative, my normal experience is not being thought about, always being a surprise. If someone has thought about you and not got it perfect, that's so much better. And it's a starting point for a conversation. But if we feel like we have to, like, access is often treated like an apology. It's like people half do it or do it a little bit or do it and don't say. And the thing about that is that if you don't name it, people can't find it. It's calling to community and it's calling to, it's starting a conversation and inviting someone to try something out. And if you don't get it right, it's so much easier to have, to be like, to have started that conversation and to be able to work from something towards getting it better than it not existing at all. And if you don't, and particularly why it's important with relaxed performance, so often people will, they will say it's a relaxed performance. They'll advertise it as relaxed performance. The venue will know it's a relaxed performance. The performer will know it's a relaxed performance, but they don't do an announcement at the start of the show that acknowledges it's a relaxed performance and explain that to the whole audience. And if you don't do that, then what happens is that default expectation around silence and stillness, and as that as the respectful way to be in a performance, that will always rise to the top. And as soon as it goes quiet, if I'm making noise, everyone will turn to look at me. So the reason that saying that being clear about access and factually describing what is that, what you're providing. So I wouldn't just say it's a relaxed performance. I would say it's a relaxed performance and this means these are the things that I'm providing.
Right,
these are the things that we are committing to. But also acknowledging that you're learning and that that is a process and encouraging people to try it out and give feedback. But it is important that we talk unapologetically about access. And people often treat the exclusion of disabled and neurodivergent people like it's inevitable, like it's natural. Of course, you're not going to be able to participate in everything because, you know, your body, your mind is impaired in some way. And that's rubbish. It's not natural. There's nothing natural or normal about it. It's decisions that people are making. And I understand why those decisions are being made and maintained. And it's about anxiety about getting it right. It's about not overpromising. It's about resources or about, and the reality, like it can feel overwhelming. Like, where do I start when there are all of these barriers? But if you don't start, and if we don't start talking about it really publicly, what the reality is that loads of people are excluded from performance spaces and wouldn't feel safe to go. And like I'm really careful about biscuit my confidence around live performance, and I would be really nervous about going to a space that wasn't either a relaxed performance or where I'd had a detailed conversation, because I protect my confidence around that so carefully. Biscuit, I recently have been thinking a lot about like the privilege of risk taking. Like, you know, in the creative sector, everybody loves talking about creative risks. But there's this association with risk and disability that isn't the type of risks that gets, you know, arts organisations excited. It's like disabled people are often like associated with risk. But also there is a privilege to risk taking. Every time I go into a performance space, I'm taking a risk. And I'm not just taking a risk creatively about whether I might like or not like the piece of art. I'm taking a risk with my identity, with my body and my brain. Like, I risk people saying that they don't want me in that space, or that I'm being asked to leave or to move or to compromise my well-being in some way. And so the response, the natural protective response to that often is to select away from those things. And that means that people are missing out on cultural experiences that, you know, might radically change how they feel or view or think about the world. So I understand why you would feel nervous about it, but I would say, name it, say it, do it, and that you'll get better at it by doing that.
Yes. I've got new dates just announced now, so I should put them on those. Yeah,
great.
Yeah. Well, I didn't just get you on to workshop my tour, but I guess another thing which I did at some point want to ask you about, because I an aspect of relaxed performance which I do which I do struggle with is if there is talking near the front, I find it harder to perform as an autistic person. I think I've found that sort of like conflict of like I want to. Have like an inclusive environment, but also I know that if someone's on the front row talking loudly, my performance will suffer. How do I sort of get that balance right?
So I that's what I would understand to be an example of access friction, where somebody's access requirements rub up against someone else's access requirements. The first thing I say is that often there's this idea with relaxed performance, and just to explain, relaxed performances are performances that take a relaxed approach to noise and movement. They also provide things, pre-show information, often in easy read format that uses words and pictures to explain what to expect. They would take into consideration sensory sensitivities and describe the sensory landscape. There would often be a chill-out space. You'd be able to go in and out of the space so that you can manage your requirements. What I would say in that situation is, I'd be really clear about the fact that it's a relaxed performance, but also acknowledge your own neurodivergencies and access requirements and what that means. And I think that it would be totally fine to then, in the context of that, to then say, if you are going to make more noise, it would be great to avoid the front, for example. You could set up some parameters around that that are about negotiating space. And often there's this idea that, like, in my experience, access friction and access clashes are often used by non-disabled people to avoid doing anything, rather than if you sort of describe stuff factually, be really open and clear about what isn't and isn't possible. It's the starting point for a conversation. And actually, in my experience, disabled people are often really good at negotiating space in spaces that are open and where there is flexibility to then do things differently and to move things around. There was definitely something else I was going to say in relation to that, but I've totally forgotten. It's slipped my mind. But I think that I remember going to a sort of comedian show, and them saying something like, oh, I've prepared for drunk people and I've prepared for hecklers and I've prepared for Hindus, but I've never prepared for someone with Tourette's. And my instinct was, why not? Why do we expect to go to the theatre or to a comedy club and not sit next to someone with Tourette's or Down syndrome? And I think that says a lot about who those spaces are perceived to be for.
Mm.
And so changing that needs lots of different approaches. Not one single thing isn't going to change those long established ideas about who culture and creativity and art are for and how it should be enjoyed. But only if we start trying to make a difference. What I would say, like, my approach to that is also, you know, my tics are really suggestible, but in a relaxed performance, if I do go off track or get distracted by someone else's tic, I name that, I own that, and I, like, that liveness is part of that experience. And I genuinely find, as a performer, it demands a different type of attention from me and a different type of focus and a different type of performance. And that doesn't mean that would not always be the most polished version of a performance, but they're often the most interesting because they are live and dynamic and rich and for a community of people. I enjoy being in spaces where there is a diversity of mind and body, and that being present and leads to, you know, that does lead to moments of friction or challenge, but it also, I think, often makes art, like thinking about that makes art stronger. And it means you have to articulate things in different way and try things out. So I like, I think it's totally fine to have some, to protect and think about your own access requirements while also thinking, all right, how, what are the aspects that I can do to make this work?
Yes, yeah.
Fact.
Yeah. And
Hedgehog.
And I have enjoyed the ones which have been more neurodivergent, the tour shows I've enjoyed more.
Fact. I think often there's this idea that if you relax the rules, that there's total anarchy. In my experience, that isn't what happens. Mm. But what happens, it is allows room for humanity and for the humanity of our bodies and for inclusivity. In fact, there's nothing more certain to make me need the toilet than to go into a theatre space and be like, it's 90 minutes, no interval, yeah, no weird mission. Like, who then isn't immediately thinking about the fact that they can't go to the loo?
Yeah.
Biscuit. And you're not going to be able to focus and bring your full attention. And so I suppose for me, it's, there's this, so Alice Wong is, and has, is an amazing thinker, disabled thinker and organizer. And Alice talk, Alice talks about and has a project called the Disability Visibility Project. And there's this concept called, of access is love. And I think that as soon as you hear access is love, for me, I felt really connected to that because it's like providing access, thinking about a diversity of body and mind is a way of showing love and care and compassion for our communities. Mm-hmm. And often access is treated as labour, as hard work, as complicated, as frightening. Understanding it as an act of love just feels like a really powerful reframing of it.
Yeah. Fuck. Just like to touch on your tour show.
Sausage.
Joe, the couple that I've been to, and when you Fuck. Do the speech at the beginning that people, if they need to get up and walk about and stuff, and I'm usually stand in the back of the room because
table
I'm a
tennis.
Comedian, so I can't be in the audience.
Fuck
to
it.
Stand and watch it. What I find really cool about that situation is
fact
like kind of like you were saying, when it's like 90 minutes no interval, all of a sudden it's like I have to pee, do I have to pee, do I get up, like, because you're just stating, hey,
fact,
if you need to get up, if you need to move around, then all of a sudden if anyone moves in that space, it becomes a non-issue.
Yes.
Whereas in fact, so many situations,
policing,
especially in comedy, fact, if someone stands up just because they have to pee, maybe they want a drink, it's their night out, whatever, fact, doesn't matter. You can feel the whole room go, oh,
fact,
they're going to get in trouble with teacher.
Yeah.
And the fact that it's just like, yeah, the people are moving as they fact need to.
And for some people, that will make them feel uncomfortable.
Yeah.
For other people, that's just a barrier. That means they'll never, like, I, like, would never go set foot into a show where they felt like they were going, like, I've been in so many comedy shows. Biscuit, I really love comedy, I really love shared laughter, but it is also can be a really exposing place for me, mm-hmm, because I often feel like I am becoming the show rather than just there to watch it and enjoy it. And I think people often, you know, comedians in particular, Biscuit, are like, you know, will are used to having like a need to have control of the room and the sort of the, you know, will often, and are used to sort of prepare for hecklers and have put downs. The thing is with Tourette's is it's like, you're never going to win. You're never going to have the last word. My tics will keep going, keep going, keep going, because it's neurological. It's automatic. It's not, it doesn't follow. It's not heckling, but it sort of looks and sounds very similar. But that is an incredibly sort of exposing place to be. But there is, very small things can change that. So the permission to move, the permission to respect, it's exactly what you described. It sort of stops, as soon as people like have an opportunity to understand and be supportive, it stops a lot of that policing and that anxiety, which often comes from that concern for the performer. If a performer explains and sets up the space in a particular way, it removes a lot of those barriers and those risks, and can be can be incredibly transformative and can make me feel safe in a space in a particular way. But it is, I just think that, for me, seeing Biscuit, disabled comedians and disabled artists making funny, irreverent, nuanced work was what made it feel possible for me to be an artist. Mm-hmm. It's so important to see a diversity of bodies and minds present in the space as performers, as audience, as staff, as curators, as program. Like, that visibility and audibility of difference is so powerful in challenging those ideas about who those spaces are. Who those spaces
are for. It's just really cool. It's similar to what you're saying about love. I feel it's quite sort of punk rock as well, those environments where... Do you know Daniel Wakeford? He's a musician based in Brighton. Yes. But I went to see him live.
Hedgehog!
It was just the coolest show I've ever seen. I've seen punk bands, you know? And, like, people go and see punk bands, they think they're cool. But this was, like... Hedgehog. So cool, because anyone could do whatever they wanted. And, like, my wife at the time was struggling with lots of foot pain, so she just went and sat in the corner, and then there's other people, like, sat down, then some people dancing in the front, and it was like, I've never been to a gig so much where people can do what they want, you know? And it was, it just felt like a really cool place to be.
So I will often say, at the start of shows, I will often say, firstly, that we understand that attention looks different for different bodies and minds. And secondly, Biscuit, that we can make the space work for us as a group of people. And those things shouldn't be radical in a sort of theatre or art space. But often people respond to them like they're really radical because they are unusual. But it's like that thing about saying, right, we are a group of people and we can make this work for us together. And if something's not working for you, like I often, you know, I will say, if you can't see, like, just move. Because it's like, that's totally fine. Like, we can, this is as a relaxed performance, we can make this space work for us as a group. But it's so rare for people to feel like they have permission to do what works for their body and mind. And similarly, I will often put that responsibility for looking out for barriers and not making barriers for other people back on the audience too. And I'll say, you know, do what works. We can make this space work for us, but look out for those around you. Because it's very easy for someone to, you know, as a wheelchair user, as soon as someone's giving a talk, you know, everybody crowds around and all I get is bums. And it's like, but as soon as you put that back into the space as a sort of shared responsibility to look out for each other, And that's what community is to me. Community is about shared responsibility. It's about openness. It's not about getting it right. It's not about there not being mistakes. It's not about us agreeing or having the same perspectives. It's about us being ready to listen to each other, think about each other, consider each other, get things wrong, learn, change, try new things. Biscuit and Hedgehog, Biscuit. And we can only do that if we're also clear about what our access requirements are and what we need in a space. Mm-hmm. Fuck. Hedgehog.
I could talk all day, but I've just looked at your phone and we've got 4 minutes.
Sausage!
You're at a divergent moment.
It's time for Peter Andre's bath.
Yeah, exactly.
Fuck.
And on that note, we always like to end the show, Jess, with a neurodivergent moment from our guests. So,
Biscuit.
What is your neurodivergent moment?
Biscuit. So there's an element of Tourette's that I would call oppositionality. Biscuit. And that means doing the opposite. Automatically doing the opposite of what you should do or would want to do in any given situations. It means that I'm pretty rubbish at I spy and poker. Fuck it. I tell, you know, I get people really thoughtful gifts and then immediately tell them what I've got them for Christmas. Biscuit, but one of my favourite examples of this was being on stage in Australia and telling an audience of 300 Australians that my sister was pregnant before she'd told my mum. Biscuit. And also I was on stage with my co-performer, Jess Mabel Jones, who also didn't know, who turned around and went, is that true or is that a tick? And I was like, yeah, no, that's actually true. Biscuit. And I think the amazing thing about Tourette's for me is its complexity, its ability to surprise, the fact that I'm still learning about it decades into living with this brain and body. And I think that sometimes that can feel exhausting and wearing, but it's also interesting and exhilarating and funny and beautiful. And in those moments where you're hitting loads of barriers in the world, it can be really hard to sort of hold on to that acceptance and pride in yourself. And for me, like collecting ideas around me, which I often talk about as my emotional grab rail. So if I have a physical wobble, I can hold on to a grab rail. But I also collect these ideas around me so that when I hit barriers in the world, I can lean on the thinking and ideas of other disabled people to shore me up and to help me keep going. And that has been really important in sustaining me as a disabled person in an often ableist, relentlessly ableist world. So the one thing I have complete confidence in is the imagination, biscuit creativity and ingenuity of other disabled and neurodivergent people. And yeah, leaning into that in moments of tension and challenge and pressure is what keeps me going. Biscuit.
That's great.
Fuck.
What lovely things those three Australians.
Yeah.
To hear that for the first
time. Dildos for frogs.
A great idea. Yeah. I think we should patent it. You've told us about Tourette's Heroes. Where can we find you on the internet? Where's Tourette's Heroes? Tell us real quick.
You can find us at tourettesheroes.com, and that's where I write. We've got the blog. There's over 6,000 of my tics that you can browse, enjoy, and submit creative responses to. We invite other artists and creative people to use them as a starting point, as springboards for their own creativity. You can find us as Tourette's Hero, all one word, on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And yeah, if you look out for us, come and say hi. We are really interested in connecting with other disabled and neurodivergent people in lots of different ways. So check it out. Fuck it.
Thank you so much for coming on. Thank you.
Sausage.
Wonderful.
That was Jess Tom.
That was such a great conversation.
She's so brilliant. Her book is amazing. I think it's out of print, but you can get secondhand copies anywhere.
What's the name of it? Do you remember?
It is called, I hope it gets right, Welcome to Biscuit Land, I think it's called.
Okay.
It's certainly, if you search for Jess Tom Biscuit book, something like that,
yeah,
it will come up. It's from a blog, so it's like 2 years of blog. But it's sort of condensed into 1 year, so it's made to look like it's 1 year. It's great, like all these sort of like spontaneous interactions, which Jess talks about in the interview. Talks obviously about the harder aspects of being disabled under the social model, but also those sort of spontaneous, joyful things. It's a beautiful book. It's really brilliant.
Yeah, and also speaking of blogs. Check out Tourette's Hero, which is her blog. It's not, they have an Instagram handle, but also the website. And I bet that'll tell you how to get the book as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So have a look at that. And I just walked away from that interview with so much more to think about and such a greater understanding. I knew of Jess Tom. I hadn't met Jess before we interviewed her. And it was kind of like in the middle of the interview that I realized I've never actually met a person with Tourette's before. I've never been in the same room that I am aware of as someone with Tourette's.
Not with... I have. But I think Jess is the part of the 10% who has, I believe it's called coprolalia. I will edit in a correction if that's wrong, where she has like spoken phrases of the tics.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the people I know with Tourette's don't have that. And they are the majority of people with Tourette's.
Yeah. Interesting.
They used to be, do you remember Richard Coughlin?
No.
Comic with Tourette's. He used to, but I think he does lots of internet stuff now. I don't know much about what he's up to. I see him pop up every now and then, but he used to be on the circuit a while ago, but he had Tourette's.
Oh, wait, I did meet Louis Capaldi once. Just going to pick that name up off the floor.
Dropping
that. He has Tourette's. I forgot I met him because I meet so many, platinum artists.
And if you're wondering, listeners, yes, we did try, we're going to keep trying.
Yeah, but he didn't follow me back on Instagram, but he did buy me 2 beers. So swings and roundabouts.
At the same time?
Say what?
Like at the same time? Or is this
no,
same-
so Okay, now I feel like I have to tell the story.
Yeah, so, you got to share it.
Yeah, so I went to perform at West End Comedy Club, and I was closing, which means I was on last. And I walk in, and the MC is like, Louis Capaldi's here. And I was like, oh, wow. And then I Googled, who is Louis Capaldi? I didn't tell him that part. But West End Comedy Club is a bar. It is an extremely small room, so there's no way anyone would have not known he was in the room.
That's what, like 60 capacity?
Yeah. And and the MC actually played with the fact that he was in the room. Like, from stage, he talked to him, which I personally probably wouldn't have done, but that's what he did. And Lewis was great. Lewis, like, was totally giving and funny when he was called upon. He also did not steal the spotlight in any ways. He was just like a sound audience member. And afterwards, because he was just so cool about the whole thing, I was like, first of all, the show ended and everyone stands up in the room and just looks at their phone and side eyes where he's sitting, because everyone wants him to walk by to get a photo of him.
Oh.
And so he stayed sat down. And so I was like, I'm just going to go over and shake his hand. So I did. And I was like, hey, thanks for being so cool about, you know, everyone knowing you're in this room.
Yeah.
And he was like, oh, no problem, mate. Do you want to have a seat and have a beer? And I was like, yeah, sure. So I sat down and I had a beer with him. And he looked at me being like, man, if I could do what you guys do. And I was like, I'm pretty sure you could, Lewis. You're quite talented.
He's very funny.
But he very
also,
much...
Also, if he could do what we could do, he'd be a lot poorer. It's the end of that sentence.
Yeah, exactly. But he's a big comedy fan. He was completely gracious and lovely. And we stayed in the club till after it technically closed, which they've never let me do before. I think it was because Lewis was there. And I had a we finished a beer, and then he's like, let's have another. So we drank two beers. And then him and his now girlfriend, they just started dating at the time, were going to go to another bar. And he was like, all right, well, we're going to go here and have another drink. Do you want to join us? And I was like, I think I better go now. Because they were on a date. You know what I mean? And it just felt like, I feel like I've had my time and my interaction with this person, and it was very special. And I don't want, like, she was lovely, by the way. She's an amazing, kind, sweet person, actress, very talented. But it didn't feel, I was like, now I just feel like I'm hanging on for the story for me. I have the story. I need to go. So yeah, but he was lovely. But anyway, on that rambling,
but the podcast didn't come up.
It didn't come up at the time.
I'm the one that's supposed to be good at networking,
I know,
social skills.
Here's the thing, and this is now that I'm saying this. If I ever get a hold of him, we're gonna have to take this off the podcast. I didn't really know much about him personally, so I didn't know that he was neurodivergent, that he had Tourette's, until afterwards. And I told some people, and that was right when his Netflix documentary dropped about his Tourette's. And that's when I was like, oh, fuck. So I sent him a message on Instagram, but God knows he's not looking at those messages. And I even asked the venue if I could have his email, which they are not allowed to do, and they did not give it to me. But the venue owner was like, I can't do it. And he was like, and honestly, I think it's just an email he uses to book things. He's like, I don't think it's his real email, because the email address was something like, I have a family, please don't harass me @gmail.com. You know what I mean? Like, it was like, it's not like Louis Capaldi @LouisCapaldi.com. It was clearly like his burner email account. So, but I can keep trying.
But one day we'll get him on.
Yeah. Supposedly he's friends with a couple of comics I know in Scotland. So the next time I see them, I might try to wedge it in.
Okay.
But
it'll happen one day.
Yeah. Yeah. In super sound person. But nonetheless, moving right along.
You're in a major moments.
Let's do it. You want to do listener neurodivergent moments first?
Should we do listener ones first? I've got a lovely listener one. Do you want to go first or shall I?
I'll go first.
Okay.
So this was a comment left under one of our Instagram reels, one with Tom Watts in it, talking about small talk. And this is from corna.lea.444. And they wrote, "You know, I never understood the purpose of small talk, and I was today years old when I learned that it is a social bonding experience. Thank you. I am truly mind blown by this explanation. Why has no one explained that to me before? Open bracket, rhetorical question, close bracket."
I really want to know, like, the thinking behind, like, what small talk was before, like, whether they thought, oh, neurotypical people are really interested in the weather. They really, really care. Yeah. They're all meteorologists there.
I mean, we talk about it all the time, that small talk is so boring, and let's talk about something real. Let's talk about life. Mm. Let's talk about politics. Let's talk about what's really going on. And I'm sure Cornelia was just like, God, these people are boring. They only think about the weather and the traffic.
Recently, I have been talking about the traffic a lot, but that is just out of, I feel very passionately about that. Yes. That's not small talk for me.
But that's a real thing.
If you defend the M25 to me, then we're not friends anymore.
Yeah, totally.
I have one. I'm not going to tell you this person's name, even though I have permission, because I'm going to tell you their name afterwards. They say, "I'm loud and messy, love starting new things, hate finishing things, and I interrupt people. My brother used to tell me I was an ADHD-er, but I was convinced I wasn't because I can concentrate at work. However, one day, I had 7 minutes before picking up my kid from the childminder. The idea of just sitting in my car for 7 whole minutes waiting sounded absurdly boring. Instead, as I drove past a row of shops, I spotted a falafel bar and a shop selling a piece of furniture I liked. And I was like, in 7 minutes, I could definitely order a falafel wrap, buy that small bedside table, and pick up my child in time. And that's when I noticed an insanely fun rush of dopamine and endorphins can accompany this multitasking slash time challenge. And I was like, oh, do you think that's possible? A falafel wrap purchase, which presumably is being made fresh, buying a bedside table and picking up a child from a childminder. Presumably these things aren't right next to each other in 7 minutes.
Absolutely not.
Well, that's what, and also I thought not, because this person's name is Rebecca Kant, is actually her name. she's claiming here that she says, I asked about it, and she says, by the way, I accomplished all of it on time.
Really?
That's the claim that's being made.
Listen, so, I'm not here to say that Rebecca's a big old fat liar, who actually on time is 10 minutes late to pick up her children. But,
how long does a falafel wrap take? So let's add, so you've got to get to the falafel shop. Say that's 1 minute.
Okay, I'm thinking the make of the wrap, 3 minutes. 3 minutes, because yeah, they put it on the grill to warm up the falafel.
She says it's a falafel shop, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so this isn't like a, you know, this isn't just a place that's...
Yeah, this isn't like a pret where it's like a pre-made wrap. Hmm. 3 minutes to make the falafel. So we're at 4 minutes, and then to buy a piece of furniture.
Yeah, you've got to go in and like, also the vibe in a furniture shop is relaxed.
Yeah.
It's not like going to, you know, like a news agent where people will go, right, yeah, there's your pay here and go. They're taking their time.
Yeah.
And you've got to go into the furniture shop and change the atmosphere of the furniture shop.
You walk in and you're, I need an end table stacked. Do not wrap it to go.
Just someone running into a furniture store with a sense of urgency.
I don't have time for you to get the flat pack version from the warehouse. I'm carrying the floor model out.
That's amazing. And then picking up a child, you know, that's another. I mean, are those things right next to each other? You talk about another few minutes. If that is true, and we have to accept it as true, I'm not calling our listeners liars.
Yeah.
7 minutes is very impressive.
Yeah. We'll change her name to Rebecca Can.
Rebecca Can.
I mean, Rebecca, you are a true superhero if you achieved all that in
We talk about the superpower narrative being problematic, but actually, if you can do that in seven minutes, you do have superpowers.
You claim it. That's real. Yeah. Also, to go into a furniture store with ADHD and not get distracted by something.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like that is a level of hyper-focus, because you go into a store to buy, like, say, you know, an end table. It's like, well, these cushions are cute. And then you have to fluff them and you have to cuddle them and then you have to be, nah, it's too expensive, and put it down and then...
We didn't factor in the getting the furniture into a car as well, putting the back seats down, presumably, for an end table.
I think she's carrying the end table to the school pickup.
Right, so she's showing up to the childminder of an end table and flaffle wrap in her.
Absolutely. There is no walking back to the car. If these are all within walking distance, she's not going back to the car.
Yeah, yeah.
Between them. That's
I mean, that is impressive as well, holding an end table, presumably with one hand.
Yeah.
Or putting a flaffle wrap in a drawer. And, maybe later forgetting about it.
Oh, gosh. So many questions. Okay, Rebecca, if you could come back to us with a diagram.
Yes,
and
please,
a detailed timeline of these 7 minutes. You absolute superwoman. Yeah. Mother of the year, I call you. Absolutely brilliant. Oh, I love that so much.
Do you have a real-life moment?
I have so many lately. I would say my neurodivergent moment this week is because we were recording in a new space for Jess's interview, I made sure I left early enough that I would find the studio, and I showed up and went in the wrong entrance and just walked around for 15 minutes down the same hallway being like,
"15 minutes
must be here somewhere," until I gave up and called you and was running late for my own record because of it.
We've made it in the end. That is, in your defense, that place is a maze.
I mean, I entered in the wrong entrance, but you know how Google Maps will be like, it's right there. I was like, all I need to do is find a corridor that goes straight. Mm. I need to just find a corridor. And I just kept running into walls and locked doors. I should have called you sooner, but I did that. I think it's very ADHD to get lost and know that's a trope of being late and going, no, I'm an adult woman. I will figure this out. I do not need to call Joe Wells.
That was accepting that you were late.
No. I thought I could figure it out myself without being late, without calling you. I didn't want to call you and tell you I went to the wrong entrance.
Did you feel like if you called me, that was almost like an acceptance of being late?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
I thought I could get there on time without your help, and I couldn't. By the way, I basically had to walk completely around the building, which is a big ass building. I had to walk an extra block in order to
find Somerset House in London. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've never been
to this.
That's a huge building right in the center of London that I've never been to before.
Yeah. It was really gorgeous. Really pretty part of town. What is your neurodivergent moment?
My neurodivergent moment was I've got some new photos done, because all the photos that I've had done are old. So when I'm doing comedy clubs, they put a picture of me in my 20s up. So I've got new photos done. Wonderful Ed Moore. He said, bring a few tops to wear. I'm driving to the photos, and I realised that he meant different tops. And I have three of my perfect... if anyone can get these for me, because they've discontinued them, ASOS tall, extra large black shirt, T-shirts, the perfect fit. They're starting to wear out a bit now. I've got all of them, but they are identical T-shirts. Luckily, I had a coat as well, so I've got some with a shirt I wear over it, and some with a coat. So there is some variety in those photos.
I love it. You're like, I did bring a couple of shirts. I brought all of my favorite black shirts.
Yes.
To be fair, you were true to your look on stage. You know what I mean?
Yeah, my brand is the red shirt. I'm branding myself.
Yeah, this is your look, you know. You're not someone who's like wearing, you're all, like, you have amazing overtop shirts and coats and stuff you wear, but you always have the black shirt underneath.
Yeah, yeah. I like that. That shirt is, I mean, it's, I've been searching for a long time. I mean, this is another moment is I've got, I'm just refreshing Vinted to try and get that shirt. If anyone can source one, black, it's ASOS tall, extra large. And it's got like, it's not ASOS design. It's got the little gray label in it. It's the perfect t-shirt. I've never had anything else that compares to it in any way.
I wonder if ASOS has like a warehouse of like, you know, like a discount warehouse. Yeah. You should just reach out to ASOS directly and be like, I'm a famous comedian and I only wear your shirts.
I don't know whether I want to be endorsing ASOS. I feel like they are of dodgy ethics.
That is but, true.
They make a perfect t-shirt, or did 5 years ago.
Yeah, those young underpaid children in whatever country.
Did you get the children to make some more t-shirts for me?
I need to
contact like No Sweat or someone like that and see if they can copy.
A
copy of the design. Because they kind of trademarked that, but it is the perfect t-shirt.
It is. I mean, it's also just a t-shirt. I don't think you can trademark.
No, there's something special about it. I got one, but it was. It looked almost identical, but it was like a stretchy fabric. It was a different fabric. It wasn't quite the same, and was a size too small. But I was. It had the same label, so I thought it might be similar. One day, I will get a new batch. All those other ones will just disintegrate. You'll see me in 5 years' time, and I've just got the wearing rags of what was that?
Moth holes.
That t-shirt, yeah.
Here's a neurodivergent moment. At the beginning of this, I meant to plug our live show, and I forgot. So
let's plug it now.
Yeah. Should we cut it and put it at the beginning, or just put it now? Does anyone listen this far?
They better do. If they don't, we don't want them at the live show.
Yes, we do.
Oh, okay, we do. I will put something. I will retrospectively put a little note in saying, and I'll put it on the description.
Okay, cool. Thank you, guys. On the 26th of May, we are doing a live neurodivergent moments in Oxford at the Old Fire Station, and our guest is Phil Carr.
Phil Carr from TikTok. He does different videos.
Yeah, Phil is a notable content creator, got famous on TikTok, also posts a lot on Facebook as well, and has started posting on Instagram, does really fun, snarky videos about going to different cities around the UK.
Have you seen the one where he goes to the no-go areas in London?
No, I haven't seen that one. Thing.
I can't remember who it was. It may not have been Trump, but some sort of, you know, politician that ilk said there were certain areas in London that were no-go zones to white people, and Phil goes to them all and goes to the pub
no-go
zones. It's really funny, yeah.
Have you seen the one where he goes to Camden?
No.
That's my favorite one because I'm in it.
Get to the novelty t-shirts?
Yeah. So,
I have seen it, the one you're in.
Yeah, we met up in Camden, and we both made videos about it. And,
did you get I Like the Pope Because the Pope Smokes Dope t-shirt?
No, I tried to get him to buy a t-shirt, and he didn't. And he doesn't actually he buys pints. We met up in a bar and had a pint, and then we walked around Camden and then had another pint. But I don't think he's actually going to any of these places and buying merch, because if he did, he'd have no money for his family or children.
Camden was a very special place to me as a teenager.
Yeah.
Living in the suburbs, getting a train into London, meeting all the other goths, and getting some humorous t-shirts.
Yeah, I took him to Cyberpunk.
Cyberdog, yeah.
Or Cyberdog, excuse me, Cyberdog. And what I love about Phil, he's a friend of mine, and he says it a lot in his videos, and he says it a lot in person, where he's like, oh, you know, I'm just a 40-year-old man. I'm just so old. And I think he might even say it in our Camden thing. He's like, I'm so old. I'm not cool enough. He's only 2 years older than me.
That's what's going to happen in 2 years.
Yeah, and he's literally like, I've got this cool Camdenite with me, and I'm like, I'm your age, Phil. We are the same age.
But you're like a hip, cool American.
Yeah, I haven't had kids and don't live in Surrey, so I'm much cooler than Phil Carr.
Living in Surrey will aid you.
Yeah, but hey guys, please get tickets to the show, and we'd love to sell it out. I'm doing my best to promote it across our social medias, and we'd love to see you there. So please, 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 please.
Or if you know people in Oxford, recommend it to them.
Yeah, or yeah, send your friends. Please do, and we will see you there.
Oh, can we also plug the Patreon as well?
Yeah.
Patreon, the link will be in the description. Because one of the things we started doing, I think we've both felt uncomfortable with the fact that the first few series, we basically got neurodivergent people to work for free as our interviewees, and we sort of called favors from our friends. In this series, we're able to offer not a life-changing, a very small fee to our guests, but I'm so pleased that we're able to do that, because it's, you know, we're not just expecting people to come on our podcast for nothing, and we can do that because of the wonderful Patreon. So please keep supporting the Patreon.
Yeah, so we have three tiers: £3 tier, £5 tier, and £10 tier. And just like, we are now in a place where we can give a small fee for appearances. However, Joe and I still don't make any money off of it.
No.
Which I'm not asking you to join so we can. I'm just explaining to you that all the money from the Patreon goes into making this better and being able to rent studio space and pay our gas, and we might actually buy our own podcast equipment and start, because we lost our podcast studio. but yeah, so please, if you aren't a supporter, check it out. And thanks so much for being here, guys.
Thank you. We'll see you in a fortnight.
Bye.
Bye.